A thing that looks like a police box standing in a junkyard. It can move anywhere.
Haven, concentrate on Sin. Give priority to the detectors and the navigation systems.
There is a corridor. And the corridor is time. It surrounds all things.
On display, I eventually had to go down to the cellar.
That's the display department.
With a torch. The lights are probably gone. So had the stairs.
You are just number 6.
I am not a number. I am a person.
Welcome to British Invaders, episode 30. This is the podcast all about British science fiction television, and today we are talking about the Nightmare Man. This is Brian from Canada.
And this is Eamon from England. So we're continuing our discussion about the BBC miniseries Nightmare Man from 1981, with its science fiction, horror, and murder mystery elements. As we said in the last episode, there have been some gruesome murders on this isolated Scottish island, and the investigation continues. And in particular, we get this scene with the doctor from the island and Michael Gaffigan, our dentist hero, examining the body of the first victim, a woman whose body was found on the golf course. And the doctor asks the dentist to come and help him because, basically, rather unpleasantly, he's found that she has a number of bite marks on her body and that there's something unusual about these bites. They perhaps not human. And so we actually get a sequence where Gaffigan, our hero, gets to use some of his dental skills, and he actually takes casting of the bite marks and produces, I suppose in classic sort of murder mystery fashion, he produces a replica of what the killer's teeth must look like. And there's something rather unusual. There are elements of the bite which appear to be human, and there are other elements which seem rather strange and mysterious and difficult to explain. So it's all rather grisly and gruesome and also mysterious.
Yes, there are some things that are very odd that give the characters puzzles and give us puzzles about what's happening here. They also look at this dismembered body, which initially the police inspector, Inskip, thought it had been cut up by the killer with a knife or something of that kind, and asked the doctor, how was this done? With what type of blade? The doctor basically says that the person was torn apart, not cut, but actually ripped into pieces by someone with great strength, or something with great strength beyond normal or even exceptional human strength. So we get some very strange, odd things happening with this. And as we mentioned earlier, it's done all through the descriptions and the reactions of the characters without us actually seeing any of the actual grotesque details of the evidence. We also end up with the characters watching a sort of slideshow where the ornithologist, who was the second victim of the killer, had this camera that it turned out was rather trigger happy. So the camera actually took a bunch of photographs of what was happening as the ornithologist was attacked and being killed. And his tape recorder was also running because he was dictating notes at the time. So you had this sequence where you heard the recording and saw these photos at the same time, and it gave you something that you couldn't see everything that was happening, but you could see a little bit of what was happening. So it was quite an intense scene that was there.
And it's a sort of, it's an upsetting scene. And Fiona, who has had to develop the pictures, she's clearly quite upset by it all, having had to, you know, to look at this and then to produce this show. And she finds it quite disturbing. And I think so do we. So we've got this mystery, and we've got, I think, you know, we've begun to reach the conclusion that there's some sort of monster on the loose on this island, and it's cut off by the fog, and it's very sort of classic horror in a way. And then we get another attack, which is at a remote Coast Guard station. There's a Coast Guard station on one of the outpoints of the island, and they're cut off from the main community. And I think there's 3 Coast Guards on duty there, and they have some sort of encounter, and they detect, in the aftermath of the attack, they detect radiation, because they have a Geiger counter, which I can't quite remember why they have a Geiger counter in the Coast Guard station, but it turns out quite fortuitous, because they're able to detect that the killer seems to leave a trail of radioactivity wherever he or it has been. Can you remember why they have a Geiger counter, or is it just incidental?
It was not entirely explained why they have this Geiger counter there. They said that it was part of their auxiliary kit or something like that. It was just the extra stuff they have. They happen to have one. So it was not entirely made clear, that's for sure.
Right. But it produces, you know, it produces good tense scenes of something prowling outside the building. at the Coast Guard station in the fog, and then inside the building, the Geiger counter starts clicking and going off. So, you know, in a way, I suspect we've seen similar things before in horror movies, but it works quite well. It produces that heightened sort of drama and tension, doesn't it?
Yes, the sequence at the Coast Guard station were quite intense, so that worked pretty well.
And then we're also discovering a little bit more about some of the characters on the island themselves, and in particular, the mysterious Colonel Howard, who, as you said in the last episode, Brian, he appears to be a retired or semi-retired British Army officer who's just on leave, on holiday on the island, and he says he's doing some walking and he's interested in Fiona's maps. But he's obviously taking a keen interest in the investigation and seems to be checking things out himself. But also, because he's the stranger on the island, he also, I think, comes under suspicion himself by the inspector and the rest of the police. So the mysterious Colonel Howard continues to intrigue.
Yes, we wonder why he's asking all of these questions. There seem to be potentially a number of things that are not what they seem here, that we don't know exactly what's going on. There may be more than just this strange monster on the loose killing these various people. So there's a bit of the idea that the more we find out, the less we know, because we get puzzle pieces that say, well, there has to be something else going on here. It definitely builds to something that's interesting there.
Yes. And as you said, you've got these ordinary people in extraordinary circumstances, and they're trying to work out what's going on and coming up with various ideas.
That's right.
So the sort of theorizing that goes with that, I mean, they have to, I think, as you said, the several theories get raised by the various characters and the investigators. And so we do get discussions of what could be going on and who or what the killer could be or where the killer might be from.
Where the tent was, it's only contaminated. Further out, it suddenly fades.
Then there's only one conclusion, isn't there?
Yeah. Whatever it was that was here, whatever it was killed Simmons, must be saturated with gamma radiation.
It certainly looks that way. Except that no living creature could survive that degree of radiation.
Nothing we know of. So it's got to be something outside our experience.
Well, maybe it's wearing some kind of protective clothing.
Have you noticed something? We've all started saying it.
Now, as we said before, the TV series we're talking about, The Nightmare Man, was based on the novel The Child of Vaginoy that was written by David Wiltshire. David Wiltshire was a dentist himself, and he had noticed that there are very few major leading characters in novels who are dentists. So this was something that he deliberately included in The Nightmare Man, was a protagonist who was a dentist. An interesting shift on what we usually see.
Absolutely, because we can't think of another thriller or a British Invaders show which has got a dentist as the hero. But here he is, and very striking he is. So Wiltshire wanted to try his hand at writing as well as dentistry, and he, in the sort of like late 70s, he started to produce a series of novels, of which, to be honest, details are a bit hard to come by. His first book, we believe, was something called The Homosaur, which was published in June 1978, which sounds like it's about a beastie, but I don't really know anything more about it than that. And then later the same year, he brings out The Child of the Vaginoy, the book we're talking about, which inspired this TV show, and that came out the same year.
It seems that one of his major inspirations for things were the classic 1950s horror films. In particular, Child of the Vaginoy was inspired by The Thing from Another World, which was itself based on John Campbell's Who Goes There. That's an interesting influence because one of the things these 50s films did a lot was they were based on what you didn't see. What made it scary was not the things you saw, but the things that you didn't see. And that was something that was done very well in The Nightmare Man as well, was that there is a lot where you know about the killer, you see things from the killer's perspective, but you don't see the actual killer or the actual monster until very late in the show. And a lot of the evidence for what has happened, the actual bodies and things like that, are described as being very gruesome, but you never see them.
Yeah, and as you say, like The Thing from Another World, we've got an isolated community. I mean, there I think it was an Arctic research station, and here we've got this isolated, cut-off community on an island, and as you say, the beastie is prowling outside in the fog or in the snow, and we never see it until the climax. and what's going on inside the community is almost as gripping and dramatic as what we think might be going on outside.
And I think that was very much the case in the novel as well as the television version.
Yeah. So after Child of the Vaginoi, he went on to write one more science fiction book, which I think was called Genesis 2, which I know nothing more about than the title. And then after that, he seems to have switched to largely historical novels, according to his listings on Amazon.
And most of his books, especially the earlier science fiction ones like Child of the Vaginoi, are out of print and almost, if not completely, unavailable. So he, as an author, is really quite obscure at this point.
Yeah, I mean, some of his historical books seem to be available, but as you say, the science fiction ones are only available in secondhand copies from, out-of-print booksellers. Tricky to track down.
Yes. The Nightmare Man, like many other BBC science fiction productions, as we've discussed before, had a number of connections to Doctor Who. The obvious ones, as we mentioned in the previous episode, you have Robert Holmes writing or adapting from the novel, and you have Douglas Camfield directing. So these were a couple of classic Doctor Who crew people from that era of the 1970s.
But also, as well as the production team connection, we've also got a number of the actors who would either go on to be in Doctor Who or had already been in Doctor Who when they made Nightmare Man. So James Warwick, who played our dentist hero Michael Gaffigan, would the following year, 1982, appear in a Fifth Doctor serial called Earthshock, which is a Cybermen story with the Fifth Doctor, played by Peter Davison. And Jonathan Knuth, who played Colonel Howard, he'd already been in a Fourth Doctor serial called Underworld a few years earlier, back in 1978.
And Maurice Rose, who played Inspector Inskip, went on to have a very memorable performance as a gunrunner in The Caves of Androzani, which was the final story with Peter Davison as the Fifth Doctor. So you have a number of these actors that were also involved in Doctor Who.
And as we also discovered from the production notes, David Wiltshire, the author of the book, had in fact submitted a script for a proposed Doctor Who serial back in the 70s, which he'd sent an idea for a script to Robert Holmes, but it was never taken up. So there's a sort of a tenuous connection there as well. But there's also, I think, as well as the people involved, perhaps, possibly, The Nightmare Man has a sort of Doctor Who feel to it in places. And I, particularly the first time I watched it, I felt it was like a Doctor Who story where the Doctor doesn't turn up. And we get this sort of base in peril idea, which is a familiar theme in some of the Doctor Who series over the years, where we have an isolated community, something terrible starts happening, and it's almost like we're waiting for the Doctor to turn up and solve it, except in this situation, nobody turns up to solve the mystery, and it's left to the Islanders themselves to prove to be resourceful and try and get themselves out of this rather nasty situation.
It does have a bit of that feel of being a bit like a Doctor Who story, and in some ways it's not surprising when you have Robert Holmes and Douglas Camfield behind it. But in a way, I also felt that it was a little bit like a classic detective story, although with more of a horror and science fiction kind of feel to it. But it had a bit of the idea that this almost could have been like a Poirot or a Kojak type story or something like that. But there's no big detective character who can come in to solve everything. It's left to the people who are there, who are just ordinary local people, to figure out what's going on and do it themselves. And that brought a certain charm to it, I thought.
Right. So as you say, the Doctor doesn't turn up and the famous detective doesn't turn up.
Which I think leads us into a few of our opinions, the ups and downs, the good and the bad. What did we think of The Nightmare Man?
Okay. Well, I mean, again, it's another, I think, fully committed team making this. All the performances are pretty good, particularly the leads are very good as well. So yeah, I mean, the production of it is fantastic, really.
Yes, the performances are strong for sure. And I felt the writing and the pacing of it moved quite well. I really quite enjoyed it. I also felt that this idea of it being more or less ordinary people banding together to solve this problem was something that I really enjoyed. The fact that you didn't have a flamboyant character like the Doctor from Doctor who comes in and knows everything and can figure out everything and solves it, or one of these famous detective type characters who can go in and figure everything out. Instead, you're left with Inspector Inskip, who is competent and knows what he's he's doing, but knows very early on that this is essentially beyond him and beyond the resources he has there. And because of the fog and other reasons, they're really cut off and they can't bring anyone else in. So you end up with people like Michael Gaffigan, who's a dentist, being a major part of figuring out what's going on, and Fiona, who mainly because she can do the things with the photography and developing things and she knows the island so well, she becomes heavily involved with it too. And those types of things I thought worked really well in this.
Right. And I should mention while we're talking about Fiona that Celia Imrie is fantastic, as she seems to be in just about everything she's in. I think she's always very watchable. So I enjoyed her performance here. And I also have to mention just briefly, there's one of the character actors playing a minor role. The police sergeant is played by an actor called James Cosmo, who, again, I always enjoy him whenever he turns up on British TV or in film. And we'll come back to him in the future on British Invaders when we cover a show called The Stone Tape. But he was also, I think he was in UFO as well.
And with actors like him and Maurice Rose, you got some really good chemistry going there in the police station, and you had good character chemistry with Michael and Fiona, the sort of two main characters as well. So there was lots of good character work in here, and that was really fun.
Yeah, the setting's good. We've mentioned the island, which wasn't an island, of course, because it was Cornwall, but it looks like an island, and it looks like it's cut off, and it certainly looks like it's lying in a thick fog bank, and that's all quite spooky.
They also used these perspective shots where you would see right from the very beginning, from the killer's point of view. You won't see the killer for a long time, you know, until the fourth episode, but right from the beginning you see what the killer sees, and it's filtered so it looks red, and you have the sort of inhuman growling types of sounds, and that worked pretty well, I thought.
Yeah, the point of view stuff from the killer is quite notable, and it seems to mirror sections of the original novel, where I think at the start of chapters in italics there would be a description from the killer's point of view of what was going on. And so we get, as you say, this gruesome red filter and the noises, and we see what the killer's seeing and we don't see the killer. So that does work well. And the whole thing cracks along. As we say, it's four episodes of only 30 minutes each episode. They keep the pace going and they get through it all quite quickly. Although I suppose in a way that could also be a criticism, because it is quite, I suppose it's quite short. Probably one of the shorter things we've discussed on British Invaders.
Yes, this is the shortest thing that we've discussed so far.
Right.
In the fourth episode, there are a few weak points. I think the fourth episode had more weak points than any of the others, in part because it's then that you finally do see the killer. And what they use to do it in terms of production is somewhat dated. It's one of the few things in the story that really does feel dated, is when you finally see the killer, or start to see sort of glances of the killer in about episode three. The way they could actually do that and see the killer on screen is rather limited, certainly by our standards now, and a little dated.
Yeah, although as you say, that's always in a way a problem, because we do find it much scarier when we can't see the monster, and when the monster finally turns up at the end of the Thing from Another World or any other horror film, in a way it's perhaps not quite as scary as we'd imagined it, because up to then our imagination had been painting some much more vivid pictures than perhaps production allows. It's also pre-Watershed, as we've said, so the gore and the violence is all suggested by character reactions and character comments. We don't get to see any of the real horror of what the killer does to his victims or anything like that. There's very little blood involved.
That's right. I thought that worked fairly well. The climax, when we actually get to it in the fourth episode, is rather quick, and then it's over almost right away.
Oh yes, that's right. We were going to mention that, because as you say, in the fourth episode, I mean, it's been great up till then, because we've had all these theories. We've had these, as we keep saying, this ordinary community trying to explain what's going on. And so we get lots of theories about what might be happening. And then, of course, in the fourth episode, they have to tell us exactly what has been happening. And so, as you say, we do get characters standing around quite a lot in the fourth episode and explaining stuff to each other, and therefore to us. And then we get the conclusion, which, after all the talking, the conclusion happens really rather quickly. Possibly, as you say, in order to conceal some of the defects of the actual killer and the production of the killer when we finally get to see it.
Perhaps. It did have impact, but it was very quick and perhaps could have had a little more impact than it did. The sequences in the fourth episode where you do have a lot of description and explanation of what has actually been happening, I thought they actually worked pretty well, in that the revelations as to what was happening, some of of them were pretty big and really did hit you with a few surprises and things that I was certainly not expecting. So there were some neat things in there. And the different ideas that the characters have as to what might be happening, all these different theories to try to explain things as we go along in the story, are all very good. You know, instead of having something where the main character gives half a theory and it turns out to be right, then he gives the rest of the theory and that's right too. You had a whole bunch of different theories, many of which turn out to be completely wrong or partially wrong, or maybe some of them are right. But you have all these ideas popping up about what might be happening, and many of them are not true. And that was something that worked quite well, too. It was really fun.
Yeah, it was. But as we say, when we get to the fourth episode, when they do tell us, I think I would have preferred it if they'd done a bit more showing and slightly less telling. But there you go. There is also, one other thing I noted, which is that the Nightmare Man, I think perhaps because David Wiltshire wasn't a terribly experienced writer when he started, he does draw from a lot of other sources. We've said that he was, you know, he acknowledged his debt to classic science fiction like The Thing from Another World. But there's also other elements, as you know, we've mentioned a sort of Doctor Who comes into it. And there's something else as well, which is difficult to mention without giving away, because as you can tell, we're trying hard to avoid spoilers on The Nightmare Man. So I won't mention it, but there is a theme which we've discussed on a previous episode of British Invaders, which sort of plays out particularly in the fourth episode with one of the big reveals.
As much as we've banged down on this fourth episode, I actually did enjoy it a lot. There were some really neat things in that fourth episode that gave you some great twists and revelations on things and really pushed things along really well.
Yeah, and as we've said, there are a lot of revelations and reveals in the fourth episode. And as we, you know, as you said earlier on, all is not what it seems. And in the fourth episode, we find that is in fact the case. There is some, there's been some strange stuff going on.
You see, there are no injuries consistent with the use of a knife, Inspector. It is strength. You mean he did all this with his bare hands? I couldn't believe it myself at first, but the injuries to the bones and the ligaments are clearly caused by torsional force. He must be as strong as a gorilla. Maybe more than one person was involved in the attack.
Oh, no, Alan, I won't have that. No, not two raven nutters on the run together.
There's another possibility.
What's that?
The way you said the corpse was laid out made me wonder if it was some kind of a ritual killing.
You mean a sacrificial offering?
Shall we talk about the availability of The Nightmare Man? Certainly, it seemed to be very successful when it came out, although it was only shown the once on the BBC in 1981. But the ratings it received were pretty positive, and it was reviewed very positively at the time.
And it was never actually repeated in the UK. And the foreign sales for it, there were actually a few foreign sales. Apparently, I think Ireland and Holland, Barbados and Trinidad and Tobago. But I haven't heard any reference to it being sold in Canada or the US or even Australia and New Zealand, which tend to be very common markets for these BBC productions. So it had surprisingly few broadcasts, just the one in the UK and a few other places, but not in the markets that you might expect.
Which is strange in a way, because I mean, particularly the BBC has always had this slightly unwanted reputation that it's always repeating shows and that it was full of repeats. And yet, as we've discussed before, with some of the shows we've covered, the sort of genre stuff we're talking about often doesn't get a repeat, which, you know, with something like this, which is 4 30-minute episodes, it seems strange that they wouldn't be able to find a repeat slot for it at some point in the 80s or even since then.
That's right.
And of course now, you know, with the various online and the BBC iPlayer and options like that, in fact it's far easier to see repeats of BBC shows than perhaps it was in the 1980s. So it finally came out on a Region 2 DVD, which was released in early 2005, so nearly 25 years after the show was first broadcast. But I don't think it's had a Region 1 release at all, Brian.
No, there is no Region 1 release, and it was never released on VHS. So that was the only commercial release of it, was that Region 2 DVD.
So certainly in the UK, it's very easy to get hold of because it's still available on Amazon. And in fact, it's extremely cheap. I think it's just a fiver at the moment on Amazon, but it's also available on the rental sites. But I think in North America, in America and Canada, Brian, it's slightly harder.
Yes, you won't be able able to find it in the US or Canada, as far as I know. You'll have to import it.
And I should perhaps at this point out that if you are searching for Nightmare Man, if we've sort of whetted your appetite for it, don't confuse it with the horror movie that came out earlier this year in 2008 of the same name, which has got nothing in common apart from the name, The Nightmare Man. It's just the Region 2 DVD, which is pretty much a straight DVD. There's no extras on the disc itself. There's just the four episodes.
And there is a release notes booklet that comes in it with it, which is chock full of spoilers. I noticed that there is even a spoiler warning at the beginning of the booklet, which is interesting to see in a hard copy printed booklet that comes with the DVD. And both the text and the photographs in the booklet do have spoilers. That booklet is perhaps the most detailed and complete set of information about the Nightmare Man that you will find.
There's not a lot more information out there. I mean, certainly the Wikipedia page is very brief. And as you say, the only information to be found really is in this production booklet. The novel was released or re-released in a paperback with a TV tie-in cover featuring an image from the TV show.
Now let's give our recommendations for this one. I really enjoyed The Nightmare Man. I would recommend it. It was a good, solid production for its time, and the pacing, which we will all often talk about early 80s things as having slow pacing, that was not the case here. The pacing was pretty good. It was kept up. It was interesting. You had some good, solid performances from the actors. We mentioned a few little issues about things that were problems with it, but the pluses by far outweigh the minuses in this, so I think it's well worth checking out as a rental of this DVD or buying this DVD. It's worth checking out. It's really good stuff.
Okay. I've had two experiences with Nightmare Man. I watched it the first time I watched it more or less straight through, sort of 2 hours continual viewing. And I have to say, the first time I watched it, I wasn't terribly impressed. It certainly moves along quickly, but it perhaps it almost moved too quickly and it just seemed to be over rather rapidly. And as I say, the first time I watched it, I got this feeling that it was a Doctor Who story without the Doctor. But then more recently, before we did this recorded this episode, I've watched the show again, and this time I've taken Brian's advice. I've taken your advice, Brian, and watched it in a sort of more serialized form. So I watched one episode a week, and I have to say as well, I also watched it by myself this time in the dark, in a darkened room. It was much more impressive the second time, actually. I had a much more enjoyable experience the second time round. So I'm going to give it a recommendation as well, particularly if you're in the UK, because you can pick it up so easily and so cheaply, and it is a fairly short, self-contained show. But do, I think as Brian has suggested for other shows on British Invaders, perhaps do try watching it in the original sort of serial fashion. Watch one episode and then come back to another episode a few days later or whatever.
That's not a bad idea. It certainly can help with the pacing for some of these things.
Yes, and I think you've mentioned that before for things like Sapphire and Steel and Time Slip, that it works quite well.
That's right. I find it works well for a lot of things. It varies. Some it's more important than others, but it definitely is a nice way of looking at things.
Good.
So, in summary, The Nightmare Man was a 1981 four-episode BBC TV miniseries that was about a strange series of murders on a small and very isolated island out in the Hebrides off Scotland. It tells the story of a bunch of characters who are more or less ordinary people figuring out what is going on and dealing with the results of having this killer in their vicinity when the killer is not in fact a mundane murderer, but is evidently something much more sinister than that. And it develops with all kinds of revelations and interesting things happening in it, and comes to quite an interesting conclusion in the end.
And it's good, creepy, spooky, scary stuff along the way. And as ever, if you've seen The Nightmare Man, do please tell us what you thought about it. Or if you decide to watch The Nightmare Man after listening to us talk about it, perhaps drop us an email at some point in the future when you've done so and tell us how you got on with it.
Yes, please do that. You can reach us at BritishInvaders@gmail.com, and you can find us at www.BritishInvaders.com. Next time on British Invaders, we will be talking about Doctor Who, the missing episodes. That is, we will be talking about the many episodes of Doctor Who from the 1960s that are no longer in archive, but there are still some remaining things that you can see from those episodes that are interesting in and of themselves. So we'll have lots to talk about then.
We'll be talking about something that isn't there. More mystery.
Absolutely. So thank you very much for listening. And this is Brian from Canada signing off.
Yes, thank you. This is Eamon from England saying goodbye.